Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes. Sorry for a slight delay in getting on air here today. I continue to be in New Zealand and makes it a little more awkward for our broadcast. This is Zero Point Radio Show. And I am hearing an echo here, so I hope the listener isn't hearing the same, but we'll carry on and hopefully not have difficulty.
It's not very good, then.
I would encourage listeners to visit my website at www.zeropoint, spelled out zeropoint.ca for Canada. And have a look at the work I present on my site, and it gives a fairly extensive sample of my writings. In New Zealand, I've reproduced very nice copies of my major work called The Heart Doctrine, and so beautifully produced. We're back on air again. We have had a bit of difficulties here with an echo. I hope this is sounding a little clearer. As I say, I'm Christopher Holmes, coming to you from New Zealand, and I was just mentioning that we may cut off here. I'm not sure. I seem to get an echo again of my own voice on air. But hopefully that won't be a problem. I'll just connect here with my co-host, James Moffat, and see how James comes across to me. Jim is a regular co-host on Zero Point Radio, and he's in Toronto, Canada. Jim, are you there?
I am. It's a little bit better for me to hear you now than it was before, but you're still a little murky. You sound like you're down at the bottom of the well somewhere.
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, that's not good.
No, I can understand you, though. I mean, how can you hear me?
I can hear you okay. The difficulty for me more is my own echo. I hear my echo delayed, like, by half a second.
Oh, that's not good. We're having a few problems today.
welcome. I'm back again. It's Christopher Holmes. And we've all some technical difficulties we're having a little bit with these phone lines, but hopefully we'll just push through and the sound will be okay. And I was introducing my co-host, James Moffat. Jim from Toronto, Canada. How are you hearing me, Jim?
You're a little bit murky, but there's no echo or anything. How are you hearing me?
I'm hearing you okay. I'm getting an echo from my own speech, which is difficult. So I can ignore that and push through here.
Okay. It makes for very interesting radio. Hi, how are you? I'm fine. How are you? How are you hearing me? Oh, I'm hearing you fine. Very informative.
Okay. Generally, just to introduce the show a little bit, my background, I'm a clinical and forensic psychologist and mystic scientist. Through my life, I've studied the mystical and spiritual teachings. I began with the study of the Gurdjieff Uspensky Fourth Way teaching, and then studied particularly the secret doctrine of H.P. Blavatsky and the teachings of Theosophy, as well as being studied in Sufism, Kabbalistic teachings, esoteric Christianity, yogic Vedic teachings, and a variety of other mystical sources. I've also, through my life, been interested in the study of physics and creation science, as well as the general issues of evolution and education and such. So through this show, the main focus is on studying the issues of the nature of human consciousness. And this is related to the issue of the question of the existence of the human soul, and what is the soul, and how is that different from the spirit, and trying to understand the nature of our multidimensional reality. I would maintain, as a scientist, that there's overwhelming evidence that we do indeed exist in the multidimensional universe, with all kinds of undeniable evidence for out-of-body experiences, ESP, psychokinesis, ghosts, reincarnation, and many other psychical phenomena. I came to that conclusion about 25 years ago that these phenomena were valid, and thought instead of trying to prove the existence of these phenomena, we had to move beyond that to try to develop an alternative model of the structure of existence, or the nature of existence. How are these phenomena possible? And what does that teach us about the fundamental structure and nature of reality? And I would say it's only within the last 10 years that new ideas have emerged, particularly in modern physics, which allow us to understand how these phenomena might indeed be possible. So one of the main arguments in my work is that the whole of the Western tradition has been fundamentally mistaken in assuming that the brain in the head produces human consciousness. And I call this the head doctrine. And in science, there is actually no evidence to support this contention, because scientists are completely unable to define what part of the brain in the head produces consciousness, what that consciousness is, and so on. So within science itself, these are completely unresolved issues concerning the nature of consciousness. In fact, this is the fundamental issue, not only in psychology, but also in science and other disciplines. In contrast to the head doctrine of modern science, I articulate what I call the heart doctrine. And this is the viewpoint which is within all of the spiritual and religious psychologies, that the essential self or I experience of a human being is connected to the human heart. In mystical teachings, the mind in the head is often compared to the moon, which only reflects the light of the sun. And the heart I would associate with the sun, that the individual spirit soul, or the jiva atma, or the monad, or the divine spark of the Sufis, or the God spark of Shirley MacLaine, this element within the human being is connected to the higher dimensional spaces of the human heart. And that the human heart is not simply a physical organ, but there is a whole higher dimensional physics to the human heart. In Kabbalistic teachings, it is said that there are four worlds. These are called the worlds of emanation, creation, formation, and the world made. Similarly, I would argue that the ultimate source of human consciousness within the heart is within the world of emanation, that there is a divine source emanation, a God spark existing within the higher dimensional space of the human heart. There is subsequently a spiritual heart, a psychical heart, and a physical heart. So there's this whole higher dimensional physics to the human heart. Now the word consciousness is so widely used in alternative ways, and in Western psychology, I argue we've made a series of mistakes about the nature of consciousness. Firstly, we've identified it with psychological functions of thinking, feeling, and sensation. In contrast, I would compare consciousness most as being most similar to light, and that there is an inner light within the human being, and this light of consciousness illuminates the mind and emotions and sensations, allowing us to be aware of our own thoughts and feelings and sensations. The consciousness itself has to be understood in terms of light. It is also useful to understand consciousness in terms of it being similar to a form of nothingness or of space. Now, just as you exist at the moment in a room or you have a space around you, and if I ask you, what is the color of space? And you would have to admit that space has no color. Space also has no touch or sensation or taste or smell. In fact, space has no sensory attributes. But it's only because of this existence of space as a form of emptiness which allows you to then be aware of all these things, all the objects of your perception and experience. Well, similarly, I argue that a human being within the higher dimensional physics of the human heart has a vacated space or a form of emptiness. And it's because of this nothingness at the heart of being which allows you then to be aware of all the things. That this nothingness is a precondition for the discernment of phenomena or the different things which as occupy space. So I try to explore consciousness both in terms of it being a form of light, and this light as being, as illuminating the emptiness within the heart. So I'm arguing there's an actual physics to this. And in modern terms, it's related to what are called zero-point fields, and new ideas about the nature of the quantum vacuum. In modern science, the newest ideas in physics suggest that space is not really empty, but the more we get down to the level of what are called the Planckian units, we find that space is full of an infinite amount of energy, or a vast amount of energy, that permeates everywhere. And that the phenomena of our experiences are only like small ripples on the sea of this huge amount of energy that underlies all phenomena. In mystical teachings, it is said that God is omnipresent, omnipotent, and omniscient. This implies that if we examine space at a micro level, that indeed there should exist an infinite amount of energy latent everywhere within space. Because if God exists, then this infinite energy is pervasive everywhere. And the phenomena of our lives and experience, in a way, is an illusion projected out of this higher dimensional physics. So in the zero-point teaching, I argue that a human being has a monadic essence, or a jiva-atma, or a divine spark, and this element exists within a seven-dimensional hyperspace. And this idea of a seven-dimensional hyperspace is now a mainstay in modern physics. And I would argue that this monadic essence has spin properties, and it spins around in higher dimensional space, and the spin properties of this monad are imparted into the quantum vacuum surrounding the central point. And what this does is it breaks the symmetries within the zero-point field, which creates different realms of matter out of the ethers, and so the zero-point center is then surrounded by different bodies, so that the monadic essence is then embodied in different sheaths or vehicles for awareness upon corresponding planes of existence. Now, this is all a complex model, and in large part, it's based on the secret doctrine of H.P. Blavatsky. The idea in the mystical tradition is that we want to attain and cultivate the consciousness of the human heart, and that most people in their egoic consciousness are centered in their minds, in their heads. But in a way, there is a deeper level of self involving this higher dimensional physics of the human heart. In the book, The Prophet by Gibran, the people come to the prophet and ask him, tell us of self-knowledge. And he says, your hearts know in silence the mysteries of the days and nights. Your mind longs for the knowledge, the secret knowledge of your heart. Well, similarly, I'm saying that we as human beings have to dissolve this egoic mind complex centered in the head in order that we might awaken and cultivate living within the heart. So cultivate this self-consciousness of the heart. One Eastern yogi defined yoga as the dissolution of the false mind into the lotus of the heart. So I would argue that this attainment of heart consciousness is the next step in the evolution of humankind. That most people are controlled by the three lower centers, which exist below the heart center in the system of chakras. And the three lower centers are the root chakra, the sexual center, and the solar plexus center. and these are related to the motives of money, sex, and power. So much of life focuses on the attainment of money, sex, and power. And it's only through the transcendence of those motives and the awakening of the heart that we begin to experience higher emotions of compassion or love, appreciation of beauty, love of God, remorse of conscience. These higher beatific emotions. If we then awaken in the heart, I would argue that there are three higher centers, and that the light of the consciousness of the heart can then illuminate the higher centers and allow us to experience higher dimensions or psychical or mystical powers, or have such experiences. For example, awakening of the brow chakra or the third eye. Blavatsky says in her book called The Voice of the Silence, I'll read a few verses from this. She writes, "Search for the paths, but, O disciple, be of clean heart before thy startup on thy journey. Before thy takest one step, learn to discern the real from the false, the ever-fleeting from the everlasting. Learn above all to separate head learning from soul wisdom, the eye from the heart doctrine. The doctrine of the eye is for the crowd, the doctrine of the heart for the elect." See, often in modern times, people associate the symbol of the third eye with the Illuminati. And you see the third eye represented in the top triangle of the pyramid. Well, Blavatsky is saying that the doctrine of the eye is a lesser teaching than the doctrine of the heart. And I would argue that this doctrine of the heart is the hidden esoteric teaching latent or within all of the world's religion. And that this doctrine of the eye and this teaching of the Illuminati is lesser than that of the doctrine of the heart. Okay, so that's a little bit of the background to the zero-point studies and the idea of the heart doctrine. And we encourage people in their life to practice a method called self-remembering as a way of developing individual consciousness. And the idea of self-remembering is that as we go about our lives, whenever we can remember to do it, we make an effort to bring our attention back to being here now, present within the circumstance of our lives. Usually people are dominated by the turning of the mind and thinking about the past or the future or imagining things in their heads. Well, we try to bring our attention back into the immediacy of the moment and to sense ourselves physically, to be breathing and cultivate our deeper breath, and to be present in the moment. So someone who undertakes to self-remember begins to go through life making these efforts to bring their attention back to being in the moment here now and cultivating that awareness. I used to teach an approach to offender rehabilitation in the prisons, whereas most of the approaches today are called cognitive behavioral. And the idea is that we have to change a person's thinking in order to bring about behavioral change. In contrast, I argue that we need a program for awakening of consciousness and the heart in criminal offenders. that in a way we need to bring about deeper change within people, and this can only be done through bringing consciousness into the heart and help a person recover the deeper experience of essential I connected to the heart. We always connect the heart to the soul. Okay. In contrast, modern theories have thought that the soul might be connected to the pineal gland in the head, related to the ideas of Descartes. But the ancient wisdom teachings articulate that true I is connected to the heart. Okay, that's a little bit of background into the heart doctrine and some of our studies. I'm going to bring Jim in now and just open it up a little bit, Jim. Welcome. I'm hoping that we're coming across okay and the sound is fine. Are you hearing me okay, Jim? And
yeah, it's a little... You're a little bit murky, but I certainly can hear you and the content. I've been following a very, very interesting presentation and overview of the heart doctrine and the differences with modern psychological interpretations of consciousness. It's interesting. A few weeks ago, I had meant to ask you this when we were on before, but and also just it's been on my mind to ask you this, for, I guess, from some of the things that you presented over the past several shows, that the question is that I was thinking about was that what do you, if someone asked you what is consciousness, what would you say? And your presentation right now has definitely provided some of the perspectives. I mean, it's an intriguing question because it's a very complicated question with multiple levels of answers in a sense. But you know, William James, the American philosopher and founder of Father of Psychology, said that consciousness is the most mysterious thing in the world, described it as the most mysterious thing in the world. And in trying to define it, in a sense, you are kind of confronted by the limitations of thought to express something that in some ways is beyond, it can't be reduced to rational and logical categories, but in a sense you can kind of describe it. In a lot of ways you can describe what it's not, and what it's not is what modern psychology thinks it is, which is either an epiphenomena or another name for the psychic functions, and it's neither of those. There is something conscious. There is something called consciousness that we call consciousness, which is essential to what it is to be human, but at the same time it has sort of those contradictory, paradoxical properties, like light, in a sense that you know it's something and yet it's nothing, and it's a nothing which is something and a something which is nothing, and so that's I think part of the problem in defining it. But I was very interested in your presentation today because you said in a sense it's this nothingness at the heart of being, but in another sense it can be compared to light. And there's different ways of even understanding what you mean when you say that, because it can be compared to light metaphorically. That is, if you're more conscious, it's as if there's more light shed on your psychic functions. That's an analogy that Uspensky cites. He says it's like there are certain machines that work in the dark, and if you put a light on them, they work more efficiently, and that's his analogy of the human condition. But also, it refers to the idea of light as an electrical magnetic phenomena, and it also refers to light, which is sometimes written out as capital L light, as opposed to small L light, which refers to the electromagnetic phenomena. And this is more of a supernal light, a higher dimensional light, which is sometimes equated with spirit or with some sort of domain of spiritual intelligence. And so it's light in three different senses in that way, but that light is somehow related to that nothingness, and that's where things become extremely interesting and extremely complicated. And then there's the whole other idea in mystical and esoteric teachings that we exist in a multidimensional universe, and that we're multidimensional beings in a multidimensional universe, and that there are higher realms in which of both the universe and ourselves. And when people are conscious in these higher realms of the, of themselves in these higher dimensions, light is the universal perception and symbol of what these dimensions consist of. And so it's kind of, I guess one of the questions I had to you was, like, do you think that, that consciousness exists on different levels, like distinct, there are distinct gradations or dimensions of consciousness, like there are higher dimensions of consciousness and then there are lower dimensions, and how does that relate to human beings?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, these are all very complex issues, and we do have to approach them metaphorically in ways, because we simply can't put into words the answers to the mysteries so that people can apprehend them. We're simply trying to point towards teachings, which then people have to have direct experiences of in order to understand. But I would say, just to digress for a moment, I would say the perfect symbol of what I'm arguing about the nature of consciousness is the symbol of a point within the circle. And I'd like to just quote from Avinov, Mikhail Avinov, a French mystic. And he wrote, "The divine spark is buried deep in every soul. I engraved the symbol of the knowledge of the initiate, a circle with a point in the center. Understand me once and for all. I am speaking from experience, for it is not mere theory. All my life has been based on this symbol of the circle with its central point, this center which is in us, we must find." Now, in this symbol, in a way, the point in the center, I would say, is the divine spark, which is an emanation of the divine lux. So it's divine, higher dimensional light. And this spark exists within the circle, which represents the emptiness of space. So I'm saying that consciousness has to be understood in terms of light within space. And it's a conjunction of this divine source emanation existing within higher dimensional space, which gives rise or birth to the experience of human consciousness. So, and a similar teaching is in Aleister Crowley, in The Law is for All. And he explains that to understand consciousness, he says, we have to understand the mystical conjunction of Hadet and Nui. And he describes Hadet, where he says the first principle of magic, he says, every man and every woman is a star. So Hadet is the nucleus of any star organism. I'm trying to find different quotes here. This is quotes from Crowley. Hadet is the sun, one point concentrating space. Hadet is the infinite stars, the winged secret flame. Hadet is the central atom, the core of every star. Hadet is the unit of the microcosm. So Hadet is infinite contraction and not extended. So Hadet is like an infinitely small zero-point star nucleus of a living being. And then this Hadet exists within Nui. Now the term Nui is French for sky, for night. So we might imagine a night sky, and we have all these stars existing within space. Well, for Crowley, Nui represents the divine mother or the feminine principle. As Kali defines Nui, it is, quote, that which from which we have come, that to which we must return. It is the, quote, hollow space and, quote, the queen of space. Nui declares herself, I am infinite space. Nui is the great mother and the queen of the stars. Crowley refers to the womb of Nui and the scarlet woman. Nui is continuous and has infinite extension or depth. So in a way, Crowley's saying that to understand the magical nature of a human being, we have to understand it in terms of the conjunction of Hadith and Nui, a point source of light existing within this higher dimensional space, Nui. And here's an interesting quote from Crowley of one of his mystical states. He says, I lost consciousness of everything but a universal space in which were innumerable bright points. And I realized that this is a physical representation of the universe in what I may call its essential nature. I exclaimed, nothingness with twinkles, but what twinkle? So I guess that, Jim, is a little bit what I'm saying, is that we have to try to understand consciousness both as light and then as space, and that this light can have a higher dimensional nature, because we go from the divine lux in the world of emanation, which is reflected down into the spiritual light, which is then reflected in the astral light in the world of formation, and then finally manifests as physical light in the world made. So there is higher dimensions to light. And similarly, there are higher dimensions to space. Like there's the four-dimensional space-time complex, which we usually exist in, but I would say this is an outward manifestation of phenomena that have their origin within a seven-dimensional hyperspace. So both the light and the space must be understood in a multidimensional way. And this all ties in so nicely with the development of the holographic paradigm in modern psychology and science. Except when the holographic paradigm developed in psychology, Carl Pregram, the main scientist who developed it, said, we don't think there's a laser beam in the brain. And the holographers didn't think that the human being really had any kind of interior light source. Because when you produce a holograph, you need a source of coherent light, which is projected from a laser. Well, I'm saying that a human being actually has this higher dimensional point source of light, which is the basis for creating the holograph of human experience. And then the ethers of space present those holographic plates which allow for the experience of different realms of existence. Well, that's kind of another attempt to get at these things, Jim. But as you know from your own experience and studies, it's so impossible to really put these things into words, and people in a way have to climb the ladder of self-realization in order to understand such concepts.
Yeah, I think that I thought you know, when you began to answer this, you said, you know, these are things that are pointing to realities that you essentially have to experience through your own efforts to know yourself, and I think that's precisely correct. You know, that's I mean, we can talk about these things, and it's certainly interesting intellectually in terms that we're both scientifically trained and oriented to try to understand these things and to try to integrate different disciplines of science, whether it's psychology and physics or biology. But at the same time, the real goal in terms of what the mystical and esoteric teachings mean by self-knowledge is to know this within yourself and to know it directly. And I think one of the things that becomes apparent to you as you study these ideas is that you can start to make sense of your own experiences and you can start to have experiences which provide evidence as to how these things could be true and that these are realities. But there's something incredibly affirming and at the same time inspiring when you can begin to understand yourself in these fantastically complex and really quite astonishing ways, which are quite at odds with what we normally taught, that we're just, rather than being as mainstream modern mechanistic science suggests, we're just a complex array of molecules. This model provides a way of understanding how we are all in reality, sparks of divine sparks are at the source of our being, and that somehow we are connected with the cosmos and with some sort of divine intelligence or being who underlies creation. And when you begin to try to understand yourself that way, you realize that the people who criticize or dismiss mysticism as being too provincial or something in which people seek self-aggrandizement in because they can't understand the mathematics of physics. That's the position that Stephen Hawking puts forth. You realize that they don't have any clue as to how utterly profound and mysterious these teachings are.
Yeah, exactly. And I think one of the things that was very helpful to me in my studies of consciousness was beginning to realize how superficial Western approaches to the study of consciousness have been within the scientific community.
Yes.
Like, for instance, no one within the mainstream of modern psychology even understands the idea that we have to study ourselves in order to understand consciousness. They think you can understand consciousness by examining the nature of the brain or doing studies of other people. But they don't understand that we can only know consciousness within ourselves, which is where Gurdjieff begins. You can't study consciousness in other people. You can only study it in yourself, and you have to study it with the idea that we're not properly conscious. So we have to become more conscious or wake up in order to come closer to understanding what that consciousness is. And then you see all the assumptions of Western psychology that the brain produces consciousness, but you see that really it's only a dogma. There's no evidence for it because no one can define consciousness or how the brain produces it or where it produces it. In fact, you realize that it's only the head doctrine is only a dogma, and it's not really based on science at all. In fact, it is a pseudo-scientific viewpoint. The scientists at least should come to the conclusion that they are completely ignorant about the natures of consciousness. But really, when you come to mystical teachings, it's like the mystics are the people who, through the centuries, have examined consciousness through their own meditation and spiritual practices, which are very, complex themes and teachings, the yogic tradition, Sufism, all these different esoteric teachings, which have elaborate methodologies of how to approach consciousness within yourself through the process of waking up and trying to attain spiritual or self-knowledge. So the mystics really have the more complex and ultimately more scientific approach to studying consciousness than do the materialist scientists who really are just ruled by certain dogmas and make no efforts to strive towards self-knowledge.
Yeah, precisely. And it's interesting that, at times it's good to just state that because you have to kind of keep coming back to this and remind yourself of you know, that for the two of us, we started 30 years ago studying the Fourth Way, and we were both graduate students in psychology. And almost immediately when I began to, you introduced me to some of the basic ideas that Gurdjieff's teaching, and I started to observe myself and to study my own consciousness and to attempt to remember myself, I realized right away that this is something that is so invisible within modern thought, and especially within modern psychology, this whole idea that we don't remember ourselves and that we're not properly conscious. And yet, it's the most profound, I would say, psychological fact that's available to anyone who makes the effort to study themselves systematically. And I mean, you know, you can do it, as I've said this before, but I think it's the most profound psychological experiment that you can do is try to remember yourself, is try to make the resolve to do nothing more than to remember yourself in various situations, in the sense of try to be aware of yourself being here now. And if you're at all have the capacity to observe yourself with any kind of insight, you'll quickly realize that in most of your days, most of your time is spent in a state of semi-hypnotic associative existence where you don't remember yourself, where you do things quite automatically and mechanically. And then you might have moments when you remember your intention to remember yourself, and you'll wake up for very briefly for a moment. But what happens is that then you'll just slip back into your usual state of associative and existence, what Gurdjieff calls waking sleep, and huge periods of time will pass before you'll again remember your intention. And I remember when you were first teaching courses on this, Chris, that we used to have groups at York University in Toronto, and one of the tasks that we set for ourselves was to try to remember ourselves when we were specifically in transit, when we were going from one place to another. And even if you take a very circumscribed exercise like that, a small portion of your life, and identify that as the cue to remind you to remember yourself, well, the first thing you're going to realize if you try to do this is that you can't even remember to remember yourself most of the time. But when you do, and when you're successful, quote-unquote, what will happen is you'll wake up very briefly, and then you will fall back asleep. And hours can go by, days can go by, and then all of a sudden you'll remember, oh, yeah, I was supposed to remember myself. Now, you have these fantastic libraries of psychological research and computers and all sorts of scientific instruments, telescopes and MRI machines and all these things microscopes, all these things to study the parts of human beings. But I would say that self-remembering as a psychological experiment just completely is so much more important and powerful than the combined efforts of the last 100 years of psychological research. And when you begin to realize this basic fact, you realize, as you say, that the whole modern scientific study of consciousness, it's not that it's invalid, but it's very superficial, and it is essentially pseudoscientific, because it's based on premises which give all the appearance of being scientific, but in reality are just dogmatic assertions of unrealities and illusions.
Yeah, I agree exactly. I mean, I see it now that there has been a systematic attempt throughout the past century of psychology to maintain a materialist dogma, to deny the existence of human spirit and soul, and that led to the dismissal even of the study of consciousness, because early psychologists and philosophers realized the enigma of consciousness, and so they dismissed it from the study of the discipline for 50 years, from the late 1800s right through to the 1950s, 1960s, when psychologists again began to understand or tried to understand consciousness. But we dismissed it for so long because scientists realized issues of consciousness relate to these deeper issues of the existence of the human spirit and soul. And psychologists wanted to establish science as a psychology as science and to divorce it from religion. And so, yes, I think we have so thoroughly missed the boat. And, I mean, I believe that there's been an intentional effort through the educational system to dummy down people through academic and modern scientific studies of the nature of human existence. That scientists within, it's like when I did an internet survey of Canadian universities, and I looked at the psychology program of 13 Canadian universities, and I counted up, I wrote a letter to the universities and asked them, how many professors in your department have any interest in the psychology of consciousness, spiritual or mystical psychology, or the investigation of psychical phenomena? And out of 600 professors in 13 major Canadian universities, there was not a single one who mainly focused on these areas of study. Not a single one. Further, there was not a single course offered in Canadian universities on spiritual psychology or the investigation of psychical phenomena. There were a few undergraduate optional courses offered through the University of Calgary on aspects of yogic psychology and psychical phenomena, which are valuable. But you see that really this has been completely neglected within the educational system, and most of the people who I've known who have attempted to investigate these areas have been persecuted out of their university. Like in the mid-80s, when I was persecuted out of York University, there was Ian Curry, who was a sociologist at the University of Guelph, and he had written that excellent book called You Cannot Die, the results of a century of research on death. And he was a fascinating lecturer, but he was driven out of the University of Guelph. And then there was Howard Eisenberg, a Toronto psychiatrist, who wrote a book called Inner Spaces, looking at the importance of parapsychology. And he was persecuted out of the University of Toronto. So there's been, see, it's not been a fair science. You know, you think scientists and academics have academic freedom and impartial perspective, but really there hasn't. The investigation of psychical and spiritual phenomena and teachings has something that's been routinely persecuted within the educational system. And I always used to think this was simply because of people's ignorance. But now I see it very differently, because I think the elites of the world have intentionally made the effort to dummy people down through the educational system. I think this has been an unconscious, intentional system effort, because the elites themselves are very interested in psychical and spiritual phenomena and teaching, the principles of magic, unfortunately on the black side, on the dark side. But they haven't wanted the populace to be aware of these areas, so they've not allowed this investigations of these areas, and they persecuted people with such interests out of the educational system. So I always used to think it was just people's ignorance, and but now I see it, I think the majority of people were ignorant, and then upcoming students are socialized into what the discipline is, and people have been afraid of stepping outside of that. And you see, even in our modern world, there's only one or two places in the world where people systematically study consciousness, psychical phenomena, and spiritual teaching. There are some good centers in the United States. I think John F. Kennedy University and, you know, the University of Davis, California, used to have Charles Tart there, who was one of the most prominent consciousness researchers of the whole of modern psychology in the past 50 years. But even Dr. Tartt wrote to me at one point that he faced great difficulties at his own university, even though he was such a highly accomplished scientist and academic and writer and had published, dozens of books, or a dozen books anyway. So even someone as prominent as Dr. Tartt faced difficulties in his explorations of these areas. So I don't think it's been the people who wanted to bring such studies into the educational system, we've not been playing on a level field. I think there's been an intolerance within the scientific community. And I used to think this was just ignorance and socialization, but now I see it more as something intentionally done, that they've tried to restrict people from being aware of the significance of these areas. That's why you have all this research on reincarnation, out-of-body experiences, ghosts and everything. There's so much evidence for it, it's overwhelming. There's way more evidence for those phenomena than there is for almost any other fact established by modern psychology. And these are the most important questions that we could explore in psychology. But instead of researching and being open-minded and open-hearted, instead we see kind of dogmatism and materialistic philosophy that's dominated modern education.
Yeah, well, I'd like to respond to something, a couple of things you just said. I mean, first of all, I agree wholeheartedly with you that it's subscription to dogma, which is people from investigating these phenomena in universities, and there's such resistance to it. But see, I see it very differently. I see it as being the outcome of the last 350 years of the history of science, I think even in physics, there are certain ideas which are incompatible with a materialist mechanistic viewpoint, such as the existence of non-locality, which is proven beyond doubt. It's like it's now, it's pretty much accepted, but it has no real impact in the way people think. And I'm rereading interviews with David Bohm and Renee Weber's wonderful book, Dialogues with Scientists and Sages. It's interesting. Bohm's very, very good at pointing out how the inconsistencies in theoretical physicists' viewpoints and interpretations of things. And you see how certain conventional ideas become established as accepted truth, and yet, in a sense, they're nonsensical in the grander scheme of things and a more comprehensive explanation of things, and yet everybody pretends that these anomalies and enigmas and mysteries don't exist. And I would say that's the case in a way with psychology. I don't think it's as intentional as you do, but I wanted to quote you something from David Ray Griffin's book, The Reenchantment of Science. He's making reference. He's talking about the mechanistic materialist viewpoint in modern science, and he makes reference to James Alcock, who was a colleague of yours at York University when you were teaching there and were subsequently denied tenure. And Alcock is a professional debunker of psychic phenomena and a so-called skeptic. And in one of the footnotes, Griffin says that he's talking about Alcock's resistance to the idea of spiritual science. I think is actually the term that he didn't like. And he says, interestingly enough, he's talking about Alcock's talking about how the whole rise of modern science is based on material mechanistic viewpoints. Alcock makes his claim even though he realizes that non-materialist science is advocated by John Eccles, a Nobel Prize winner, and Karl Popper, the most influential philosopher of science of the 20th century. Also, he repeats the conventional idea that, quote, the path of science was laid down upon the foundation of materialism, unquote, even though he had reviewed recent writings of Eugene Clarin, Martin Rudwick, and others who show that this was not true, especially for Isaac Newton. So, here's a guy like Alcock, who's supposedly a respectable scientist, who puts out these essential lies. I mean, repeats these conventional ideas, which are basically not based on fact at all, and then uses them to dismiss ideas that make him uncomfortable. And yet he thinks he's an open-minded, rational scholar, and that's basically the climate that anybody who tries to investigate these phenomena will encounter in universities.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I mean, I see the skeptics as a group supported likely probably by the Rockefeller Foundation or some other criminal foundation that supports the dumbing down of Americans. It was interesting. I saw a video on YouTube the other day. Have you ever heard of something called the Reese Committee, I think it was called? It was formed in the 1950s to look at the whether or not a lot of the charitable foundations were carrying out anti-American activities, and there was a Senate committee set up to investigate this, I think under this person called Reese, who was a senator, Rentz. He was a senator. Have you ever heard of that, Jim?
It doesn't ring a bell. I mean, it was probably in the 50s. It was probably part of the HUAC, the House Un-American Activities Committee, or something like that.
Well, yeah, they were looking at whether or not these foundations, these charitable foundations, were carrying on un-American activities. And they began to look into it, and they realized that they were. In fact, they were intentionally trying to dummy Americans down through the educational system and presenting a distorted view of history and other areas of the social sciences, and that they had an agenda, which if they wanted to undermine belief in different religious teachings, because they had this concept of having a one world order and kind of one world religion and so on. And so they had this kind of huge influence, as I see it now, on the evolution of, you know, public education through the past 50 years. That the way I see it now is there's been an intentional dumbing down of America. In fact, I just heard a lady the other day on, I think it was Alex Jones, on www.prisonplanet.com, talking about, she's the author of a book called The Dumbing Down of America. And she talks about this committee and the role they played and,
But
besides that, the fact is that there has been an ignoring of these areas for the past century.
Yeah, but you can very much make the argument, and in fact, the evidence is overwhelming that so-called religious groups and religious teachings are responsible for a lot of the dumbing down of Americans too, because of their absolute refusal to consider their what science has established. I mean, I would say that people are exposed to more and more information, but they know less and less. You know that there's a lot of information, but there's very little wisdom, and there's very little. Teaching of true skepticism. I mean, skepticism, it means not just taking things on faith, but, being incredulous in the sense that looking for some sort of, evidence for things. And so much of what people are taught about everything and conditioned to believe about everything has absolutely no basis in reality, in terms of explaining things. I'm reading Peter Galbraith's book. He's John Kenneth Galbraith's son. Called The End of Iraq. He had considerable experience in Iraq over the last 25 years, and I'm just reading the beginning of it. And he goes through what happened under Reagan during the Iraq-Iran war, and how Saddam Hussein was supported by the United States, and how Reagan's administration, just absolutely refused to condemn Saddam for the use of chemical weapons and for attacking his own people with the Kurds with chemical weapons, and that American satellite information and intelligence provided targets for the Iraqis against the Iranians during the war, and all the things that ended up being used as, 15 years later, 12 years later, to justify the first Gulf War, were completely 180 degrees from the reality of what had happened under Reagan and at the beginning under George H.W. Bush. And yet, you know, nobody kind of wants to even point out these basic historical facts that, you know, like, well, if you guys were so upset about this guy, why were you in cahoots with him, you know? And that's the part that's frightening, is how easily public opinion is manipulated by governments and by the media. It's really quite astonishing how people don't seem to have any memory of things like beyond the last 10 minutes, so that they can't form informed judgments about things.
Who was it who said people don't read? There was a famous person who quoted that, kind of like that. Yeah, people don't read. It's like they sit in front of the television, and we never realized that the mainstream media were completely corrupted.
Yeah.
And taken over as the propaganda machine of the elites and the New World Order. And it's been a systematic program of propaganda, which has been perpetrated over the past 50 years. I mean, that's why you got all the major media, all of which hide the truth about 9/11, which everybody knows now. I mean, it's known around the world. All the governments of the world know the truth of 9/11. All the intelligence communities know it. You know, tens of millions of Americans know it. And yet the media kind of carry on just in denial. It was funny, I remember a couple months ago, CNN did a survey of how many people trusted the mainstream media. And they found out that only 10% of people trusted the mainstream media, you know. And the guy was kind of astonished by it, you know. It was so funny because people realize now that they're pathological liars. They cherry pick what items they want, and they distort the truth, but they're owned by these people who have perpetrated these acts themselves. Like, this is now known around the world. I mean, it's like a joke. Most of the people I know, they watch the main media just to see what the propaganda is, but really, the real news now is we need to turn to the internet and other sources.
I don't believe that, CNN.
So, you know, is it just that the people in the media have just stupid and dumb and naive? I mean, sometimes that's the case, but generally I would say no. It's been a conscious, deliberate intention to dummy down the American public so that they believe that the United States spreads democracy. I mean, the United States has never spread democracy. You know, they subverted democracy around the world to serve the corporate elites. That's what they've done. You know, they've mass murdered millions of people, and yet Americans can go out with their little flags made in China and wave their flags and think they're spreading democracy, you know? They're not. You know, the United States has become the world's leading terrorist organization. And that's not meaning to be mean to American people, because, you know, I love American people, and American people are good people. They've just been systematically deceived by their own criminal government. And now people around the world are realizing this. They're waking up to this. So it's a very, you know, I believe there's this huge awakening of human consciousness which is happening around the world. And part of this is waking up from the delusional system that's been intentionally fostered upon the American public. I mean, most people in Europe know 9/11 was an inside job. When I came to New Zealand, it's like hardly anyone here believes the stories anymore. I couldn't believe it. People in New Zealand are way more informed than North Americans because they have that distance from North America. And I've hardly met a single person who believed that Osama bin Laden did it. Everybody knows, you know. It's like the king with no clothes, you know.
No. Doesn't seem to change much.
Very peculiar world situation. You know, it's like waking up in a nightmare when you you wake up to what's been done. It's quite horrific, you know. And now you just see the kind of, like, you take the Americans, okay, now they're going to attack Iran and bomb Iran with nuclear weapons because Iran might develop weapons of mass destruction. Okay, so there the Americans are with all their weapons of mass destruction in the Middle East, ready to murder another million people, you know, with the pretense that these people might develop weapons, that they might threaten someone, or they might. The whole thing is so insane. It's so insane, you know? And yet the American people that believe they need to do this, you know, they justify preemptive nuclear war to prevent someone else from getting the weapons of mass destruction. So there you have all your weapons of mass destruction ready to destroy people who you claim might develop what you've already got. The whole thing is so insane.
Well, it's
a delusional system.
It's very much the fulfillment of 1984 with doublespeak and, you know, and manipulation of people that on a whole variety of levels. It's very disturbed, very disturbing. Run by disturbed people who are very disturbing. But yeah, I wouldn't believe that CNN poll, by the way, about 10% of people trusting the media. That was on CNN. I don't believe anything those guys say.
Yeah.
That's a paradox, because in a sense, like, so much of what gets out there is filtered through the mainstream media. In the last 5 years, you know, I always knew that they were biased, and you know, I always had political views that were outside of the mainstream, so I just, you know, I knew that there was much more going on, but I watch it, and it's just like, I can't even believe it. As you say, it's not only that they sort of that they're in denial about 9/11. It's that they continue to perpetuate these idiotic beliefs. Like, yeah, like we have the right to show our moral superiority over other people by bombing them because they might get a bomb. It's just like it's absurd. It's, you know, like there's a country with 20,000 nuclear weapons worried about, you know, says that these guys aren't allowed to have a weapon and these guys aren't allowed to have a weapon, but they got 20,000 of them, you know? They profess to be shocked that these people want one. Well, one of the reasons why they want one is because they don't want to get bombed, you know? Like, you know, that's the whole other side of it. They don't want to get Iraq'd, you know? They don't want to get the Iraq treatment from these guys. And, you know, it doesn't really make a whole hell of a lot of sense.
It's also like this delusion that the American population has that they have a democracy. And now we kind of realize that the elites have controlled both of the Democratic and Republican parties for the past 50-100 years. I mean, it's not been a democracy. People are told it's a democracy. But really the whole thing has been a scam. Like, it is not democratic. To be democratic, you have to have an informed public and an impartial media. And then you can have a democracy. But when the media is intentionally deceiving the people, and the political system is consciously and deliberately controlled by the elites, I mean, who becomes the president? That's selected by the Bilderberg groups even before the whole thing happens. I mean, you look at the election where we have Carrier Bush, two Skull and Bones members, and you can call it your choice. Okay, is that democracy, to have your choice between two Skull and Bones members? You call that democracy? That's what you want to spread to other countries, you know? The whole thing is such a farce. We thought we had democracies. It's like in Canada, you got the Liberals and Conservatives. Both of them are criminal parties. Both of them are complicit in deceiving the Canadian people about the truth of 9/11 because they're both controlled by the people who committed 9/11. So they've had to maintain the lie. So now we've got democracy in Canada where you get to, you know, make a choice between two parties of criminal politicians. and we think it's democracy. It never was. We've been deceived for the past 50, 100 years. This criminality has been there. It's not a new phenomenon. We just never recognized it, but now it's coming out into the world consciousness. I mean, this fellow, Ron Paul, in the United States is absolutely amazing, amazing individual. And this whole movement, the people waking up and the issues raised by Ron Paul, I mean, I have a total Ron Paul. He's the hope of America. He really is. He's an astonishing individual, a man with the utmost integrity, and he would bring about fundamental changes in American society. This whole Ron Paul movement, I mean, it's a phenomenon. It's the new American revolution. People have a chance to...
It would be interesting to see... I was just going to say it would be interesting to know how many people even know that Ron Paul's running for the Republican nomination. I think it's like, I mean...
Because the mainstream media completely ignores him or tries to minimize... I mean, he just received second place in, I think it was Nebraska and Louisiana. He placed second. But they don't report that. The media doesn't report what's happening around Ron Paul in an objective way. You see the criminality of the media and how they dealt with Ron Paul. Because they're so challenged by his message, which is finding such a resonance with true patriots in America that they ignore him. They give him minimum time compared with other candidates. On the public debate the other day, he got 6 minutes of speaking time relative to the 22 minutes for Mitt Romney and 18 minutes for other people, even though he's been doing better in the primaries.
And then
the primaries, like, there's so much question about the voter fraud. I mean, it's not a fair, even at the primary levels, like these new voting machines, this is another criminal thing being done to undermine American democracy. You know, they can just program a machine. I mean, when he, in New Hampshire, I'm sure he did better than, I think, the 7 or 8% vote they attributed to him. And I think the whole thing is voter fraud. So
the
media are complicit.
I kind of doubt that, but I'll take your point about the voter machines. There's a guy that, you know, if people who are offended by what you just said about American democracy or who would disagree with you should read Greg Palast. He's an American who is based in Great Britain, and he wrote a book called The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, which is a collection of his pieces. If you really want an informed opinion about what's going on with voter fraud and voting machines, you have to read Greg Palast. He's amazing. And it's interesting. He talks in his book about his attempts to present his ideas in American media and how he's basically locked out of mainstream American media. You know, once in a while he gets on, but basically he's just completely shut out. They won't reprint it. Print his pieces. They won't let him on television. And Greg Palast is one of my heroes. He's a true muckraking journalist who tells the truth and gets the shaft. And that's why he works out of Great Britain. As you say, like the farther you get away from North America, the more the incredible system of lies is exposed for what it is. And people like Greg Palast are great. I want to just mention, too, the other guy that's interesting is, and again, this goes to the manipulation of the media, but Dennis Kucinich, you know, people know him. And the way they know him is that he's sort of a punchline to a joke. I find the coverage of him fascinating because Dennis Kucinich actually says a lot of really intelligent things and really insightful things about what's going on. And all he is just treated as this, you know, this guy who's a joke. And I'm thinking, and yet, you know, people debate whether or not during the last election if John Kerry would look presidential enough. And I'm thinking, you know, George Bush is the president. You know, my dog looks presidential compared to him. I mean, you know, what a joke.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, in a way, I don't think the problem is his looks and ways he looks.
No. Not his looks. They have this whole phony category about whether or not somebody is presidential enough. They don't mean his looks. They mean is he a good enough liar to be president? That's the way I interpret it. You know, it's like it's such a stupid thing. You know, this guy looks presidential.
Yeah.
This person doesn't look presidential. George Bush was president. I mean, George Bush is a complete and utter moron. You know, I mean, how difficult can it be if he was president? You know, Gerald Ford was president. It's not that tough a job. It's not that challenging. You know, Ronald Reagan fought through his second term. How difficult could it be?
I saw a most amazing video on Video Google this last week. Have you ever heard of the Canadian journalist Benjamin Fulford? Jim?
Not Benjamin Fulford. No, is he related to Robert Fulford?
Who was Robert Fulford?
He's quite a famous Canadian journalist, cultural critic.
Oh, yeah. Benjamin Fulford, he worked for Forbes magazine. He was there. He's lived in Japan now for 20 years, okay?
Yeah.
And he wrote for Forbes, but then he quit because he said that because of the corporate censorship. But he had this most astonishing video up on the Internet, which I watched the other day. I put in the keywords Rockefeller Illuminati into a Google search, and I came up with Benjamin Fulford's interview with David Rockefeller. And it was the most astonishing, peculiar video I've ever seen. And Fulford tells the story. He claims that at one point he interviewed the Japanese Minister of Finance, who had been dismissed in disgrace because apparently this guy had been selling out the Japanese financial system to the Rockefeller cartel, and he had been exposed to the Rockefeller-Rothschild cartel. And he interviewed this ex-finance minister of Japan, and Fulford had played this role in exposing this fellow's activities. So the next day, he was visited by a ninja assassin who told him that he had to back off exposing the Rothschilds, Rockefellers, or he would be assassinated, or he could join them and become their financial, like, partly be involved in their financial community over in Japan. So then the next day, Benjamin Fulford claims that he was approached by members of the Asian Illuminati, which he says is a group of eight, involves a group of 8 million, including 1.4 million gangsters, and they said no, they wanted him to continue to play this role in exposing this, and that they would offer him protection. And then he goes on in this amazing interview. It's so peculiar because he actually, David Rockefeller is visiting the Emperor of Japan, and Benjamin Fulford actually gets the opportunity to interview him. So the video is about his interview with David Rockefeller.
Oh.
But some of what Fulford maintained, he claims, it was astonishing, his claims. He claims that the Asian Illuminati are sick of the Bilderbergs and all these Western Illuminati, and that they have made the threat that they are going to start assassinating the Bilderbergs and people in these groups unless they step back from the wars and the introduction of their new race-specific biological weapons and such. That these Asian Illuminati are fed up with the whole system of what is being done by the Western Illuminati. And he's claiming that they're threatening them that they will carry out this program of assassination unless people start turning back from the course they're on. And they don't like the wars because they're turning of the world into a war environment and economy. And the lack of, you know, the East only has minimal kind of representation to the UN relative to their population base and so on. So Fulford actually maintains that this is the case, that they put the threat out there that this is what they're going to carry out. Put in Benjamin Fulford, David Rockefeller into a Google search and watch this video. It's the most astonishing thing. I it was so peculiar watching it because I really felt disheartened one night. It's like, just boy, these people are unstoppable. Like the elites and their programs, they're just unstoppable, and it just gets worse every day, you know, with all their biological weapons and learning about all their underground bases and the things being done there. And the whole world situation is so disheartening. How did we allow such a criminality among the world elites? They've deceived us so broadly.
Well, I
don't know. So anyway, this I would get you to watch that Benjamin Fulford and David Rockefeller interview.
Yeah.
The interview with Rockefeller is pretty innocuous. He's so guarded, he really says nothing. You know, but Fulford claims, as I've said, that the Eastern Illuminati are threatening now the Western, like they're splitting in the world's Illuminati. And you never know, this might be what will save Western society, is that the Western Illuminati really begin to turn around facing this threat from their Eastern counterparts. I just don't know if that's, realistic at all. I don't know.
I would...
He has other astonishing claims in this video,
yeah.
Too.
I might be...
It is worth watching. Maybe...
I was just going to say, I might be inclined to dismiss this as being overly paranoid, but I just got an email. I just got an email from Democrats.com Unity, and I'll read it to you. This is I signed a petition a while back to have Cheney impeached, and I get all these interesting emails from these guys. Dear James. Did you know that AT&T and Verizon are capturing their customers' phone conversations and giving them to George Bush's NSA? You know, that's the National Security Administration. It would be nice if Harry Reid's Democratic Senate stopped them when they vote on the Orwellian-named Project America Act on Monday, but I'm not holding my breath, and neither should you. Why not switch to a progressive phone company that doesn't spy on you? Yeah, and, Harry Reid is the Democratic Majority Leader, and this bill is... Project America Act is a further extension of the Patriot Act and gives the government more authority to spy on their citizens in the name of protecting them. You know, like they need to, the American people need to be protected from these criminals who are running their government. And don't hold your breath if Harry Reid's not going to do anything. Don't hold your breath about Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama getting elected and doing anything about it either. You know, two peas from the same pod, as far as I'm concerned. They're both, you know, they're further extensions of the problem. There won't be, as somebody pointed out, all these things that have been done post 9/11, even if the Democrats get in, they're not going to undo them, you know? I mean, forget that. Once these things are in place, it'll be very, very difficult to ever get them undone. The perfect excuse is to have a war without end, you know, a war on terror that's going to last a lifetime. Perfect. It means that, you know, you're always in crisis. As I say, if you go back and you read about what was being said in the Middle Ages about witches, and just insert terror, it's exactly the same situation where the state controls people by creating this phony threat and then manipulating people that, you know, by screwing them, basically they're protecting them from a fate worse than death, you know.
Yeah, it's like they've got all these 600 prison camps developed in the United States by Halliburton. Who do you think those prison camps are waiting for? I believe they're going to round up the people in the truth movement and they're going to imprison them. I mean, I think they're going to, you know, the next step of the New World Order is definitely the imposition of a police state. I mean, it's already bordering on that now, and it has been for a long time. I mean, they're so, I mean, these people know no bounds. And it was amazing, though, you know, I heard Alex Jones on Coast to Coast with George Norrie last night, and it's astonishing. Because there you hear Alex Jones explaining the genocidal plans of the New World Order and the Bilderbergs on a public radio with a nightly audience of 10 million people. And he was talking about the fluoridation of the water, the inoculations with the mercury and all the inoculations and their attempts to, you know, impose a police state on America. And he's exposing this on Coast to Coast radio. I mean, it's an astonishing phenomena. So, you know, there are signs of hope as Americans wake up and people around the world wake up. You know, I think this is part of, I think we've got a couple minutes left here. It's like how we have to have this change of heart. You know, we need American police and Secret Service and politicians to have a change of heart and step back from this madness, you know, and help begin to undo all the damage which has been done instead of carrying forward this agenda of genocide that's being carried out by the New World Order. I mean, to me, there's no doubt that it is happening. You know, we're sprayed through chemtrails, we're fluoridation in the water, we're irradiating our food, introducing genetically modified food, they're trying to prevent the sale of vitamins and health supplements. The whole thing is like so absolutely criminal. And there has to be a turning back because so many people are involved in this who really don't like what they're involved in. And we need the military and the police and people to turn around and wake up and not be part of this. You know, what does it serve the police and the military to become the SS of Hitler, you know? They'll face war crimes in the future. You know, American military don't want that. You know, it's just been this gross deception of the American people and their own police and military. But people are waking up. So it's really quite an astonishing time in human history. Okay, we're down. We've got a minute left. Any final words, Jim, or parting comments?
It's very difficult to, it's like, keep your head down, you know, and pass the ammunition. I don't know. It's like, I think, you know, people have to try to pass these things on. The internet is a great tool for this, and you have to question authority. I mean, that's the bottom line. You know, you have to question authority and really look at what people tell you and ask intelligent questions. Try to inform yourself. Study history. Study these people.
Yeah.
You know, the truth shall set you free. I didn't say that.
The truth shall set you free. That's. And as Blavatsky says, another quotation, there is no religion higher than truth.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah, I like that too. Yep.
Okay, so I would like to thank BBS Radio again, and this we'll be back in 2 weeks. Thank you, James Moffitt from Toronto, Ontario, and this is Christopher Holmes from Auckland, New Zealand. Sorry for our technical difficulties. Thank you all. We'll be back in 2 weeks. Remember to remember yourself. It's time to wake up. We have to overcome this collective delusional system that's been foisted on us. So turn off your TV. Turn into the internet. Start talking with people in your community. Get active in some way. We have to turn around this madness of humankind. Okay, may God be with you all. Goodbye.
Bye.